Not the kind of history Arkansas wanted to be on the losing end of last night against Texas Tech. Razorbacks blow a 16-point lead in the Sweet 16, and they lose to Texas Tech 85-83 in overtime. The season ends with a 22-14 record. Texas Tech going to play Florida on Saturday with a trip to the Final Four on the line. Anthony Christensen joins us from San Francisco this morning to talk about the game. We'll have Christina Long on a little bit later as we preview Arkansas and Vanderbilt baseball. That begins tonight at 7 o'clock over in Nashville. Big top 15 matchup in the SEC there. But with basketball, we'll begin, obviously, the big story of the day here, and we'll bring Anthony in from California. Anthony, I come back to the saying that when you play with fire, you're going to get burned. And with Arkansas, they have played that game that they played last night many times this year, and especially over the last 4 weeks of the season. Think about the Texas game at Bud Walton Arena, the Mississippi State game at Bud Walton Arena, South Carolina at the SEC tournament, and there have been other games too. And they figured out a way not to blow it until last night. And you mess around with a really good team like Texas Tech, and you're going to get burned, and that's what happened to them last night. And this pattern, we felt like it was going to catch up with them at some point, this pattern of building a big lead and then not being able to hold it the final 10 minutes or so of regulation. It's just kind of unbelievable that we saw it play out time after time after time again. It felt a little bit like Groundhog Day, but you just can't do that against good teams and expect to keep advancing.
Yeah, no, and we're not the only ones who made that kind of conclusion. Grant McCaslin did too, the Texas Tech coach. He talked about how he, over the course of watching Arkansas and scouting Arkansas, he'd seen Arkansas build up these big leads and kind of watch them dwindle away. So that was something that Texas Tech obviously knew about and had game planned for. He was talking after the game that he was telling his team, like, this is where we want them to be. We know we're going to come back in this game. We know we're still going to be in with a fighting chance. Just got to be patient. And they were, to their credit, and they did really well. I mean, Christian Anderson, freshman, stepping up in huge moments. Elijah Hawkins didn't have a great shooting night, but then had hit the shots he needed to in the end. But yeah, I mean, I think the stat is, I think it was six of their last nine games, they had a double digit lead in the second half and then ended up trailing at some point in that game. And the thing about that is they won most, if not all, of those games. I don't remember exactly. So forgive me if I'm getting my figures incorrect.
I think I read that they had won all of the games. Like they had not blown a double-digit lead and lost until last night, at least during that stretch.
Yeah. My mind is a little fuzzy at the moment, but, we're good. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, we've seen them do it before and come out on the right side, but this time, obviously, Texas Tech is what it is. When you got an All-American on your roster, that's gonna be something that you got to watch out for. I mean, JT Toppin, I thought, was really good, and they got burned, like you said. You play with the fire, you're gonna get burned eventually, and they did. But it was a great game of basketball. I don't know. It was great cinema.
In some of those other games, at least I felt like you could feel the run coming from the opponent. You could feel it coming against Texas. I thought you could feel it coming against Mississippi State, just because of the way that they were playing offensively in the second half of those games. I didn't feel it coming last night against Texas Tech. When Arkansas went up 16 on one of those occasions, I made a comment to my son. I said, I feel like they're about to blow them out. Because Texas Tech, offensively, they had no rhythm. They had nothing up until the last 10 minutes or so of the game. I think they were at like 45 points with 10 minutes left in regulation. And so for them to turn it on the way they did, with the way they had struggled to shoot the ball, that really surprised me last night, because it felt a little bit different than some of those other games where, they left the door open for the team to come back and win it. And even, it felt like Texas Tech made that final push in regulation really quick last night. It went from 69 to 61 to 72 all in a hurry. And, it felt different than some of those other games. What do you think happened for Arkansas last night to blow the lead the way they did?
First off, I think it was a great coaching job by Grant McCasland. I think, you know, I'm not breaking any news here by saying I think he's one of the best up and coming coaches in the country. You know, he's been phenomenal. I mean, you look at the way they were working off the screen. Some of their out of bounds plays were spectacular. Especially, I don't remember if this was to cut into the lead or to tie the game or even take the lead, but one of their baseline out of bounds plays to get Christian, you know, a shot. You know, a good look was just outstanding. Just the way he drew up some stuff was just impressive. And then you also have the rebounding margin, right? I mean, 22 offensive rebounds. I know Arkansas gave up 28 offensive rebounds against St. John's and still won the game. But more often than not, if you're giving up that many offensive rebounds, you're not going to win the game. And then you also have to take into consideration some of the shot selection, I think, for Arkansas as well. I think there was, I don't remember the exact point in the game that it was, but Arkansas missed a three-pointer, grabbed the rebound, kicked it out, and then immediately took another three and missed with, you know, a fresh shot clock later on in the game. I know for sure, I don't remember exactly when, but I know it was later on in the game. And when you have a lead in that situation, you want to burn some of that clock. So that was part of it, and you could see the frustration in John Calipari's face when that happened, because he knows that's you're giving Texas Tech some clock. You're giving Texas Tech more of a chance. But I tend to want to give people credit more than I want to begrudge or anything like that. So I think it was just, you know, a phenomenal coaching job by Grant McCaslin for sure.
Nelly Davis finished with 30 points. He was the fourth Razorback ever to score 30 in an NCAA tournament game. The others were Mario Credit against Loyola Marymount in 1989. Todd Day, Credit scored 34. That's a record for a Razorback in a tournament game. Todd Day scored 31 against Alabama in a Sweet 16 game in 1991. And the last time that it happened, I was actually there, Sonny Weems in 2008 against Indiana out in Raleigh in a first-round game. And all the previous times that it happened where a Razorback had scored 30 in the first round, Arkansas won the game. That wasn't the case last night. For as well as Davis played last night, he disappeared down the stretch. He made a layup with 4:43 left in regulation. Then he didn't score again, and they needed his scoring, there at the end to try to hold off Texas Tech, or obviously in overtime to try to win that game. What do you think happened at the end that basically they shut him down?
Yeah, Texas Tech, I thought, played much better defense. You know, he didn't get to the foul line like he had. I think he had 11 free throws and was 11 of 11 at the line last night. And I don't think he had any free throws after the final media timeout, if I'm not mistaken. So that's part of it, I think. And then you also have to take into consideration just kind of the defensive adjustments that Texas Tech put into play. I think I can't remember exactly what Grant McCaslin said, but you know, he was making sure that they were clogging the lanes, making sure that he was not getting some of those easier looks at the basket that he had been getting earlier on in the game, because he was doing a really good job of driving and doing all of that. I thought JT Toppin, Federico, and Darian Williams also worked really well in the gaps. I think that's something Grant McCaslin had said. They had adjusted and made sure that, he wasn't going to get those looks, and they forced him into bad shots. I remember there was the shot where he's trying to drive to the basket, but they kind of forced him away, and he had to put something up, and it hit off the side of the backboard. And obviously you're going to be frustrated if you're an Arkansas fan in that shot, but I also thought it was just really great defense. So there's a multitude of things, and I. Again, I think the right course of action is crediting Texas Tech for its defensive adjustments and being able to shut him down, especially when Grant McCaslin had coached against John L. Davis quite a bit in Conference USA when both mm-hmm. Florida Atlantic and North Texas were in that league. I know they're both in the American now, but he's a guy he's seen before, so he's had to game plan for him before, and I guess that previous experience maybe came back to help him.
Well, Dave, you can get the latest breaking news on all Razorback sports at WholeHogSports.com. Most in-depth source for all Arkansas sports, analysis, latest in recruiting, unique stories on all your favorite teams. Subscribe today at WholeHogSports.com. You can read all of Anthony and Ethan's coverage from out in San Francisco. It's the second largest blown lead in the history of the Sweet 16. The only one that was any bigger is one of the most famous NCAA tournament games of all time. 06 Gonzaga was up 17 and lost to UCLA. That was a game where Adam Morrison just had a total meltdown at the end of the game and walked off the floor crying. This famous shot that one of those kind of like Christian Laettner hitting the shot against against Kentucky. One of those that just has lived throughout the years from the tournament. Interesting thing about that Gonzaga UCLA game, it was at the Warriors' old home basketball arena in Oakland. This one last night happened at the Warriors' new basketball arena there in San Francisco. Kind of an interesting little tie-in there. Look at Arkansas' stats. We mentioned Nellie Davis, 30 points. He was good for almost the entirety of his 39 minutes, but just kind of gave out late. I thought Anthony, the foul trouble, too. I don't know that it affected him offensively, but I'm sure it makes you a little bit more tentative. And he didn't have to be in foul trouble. There were a couple of fouls. Number one, he got his fouls 2 and 3 about midway through the second half. Got them in real short succession, I think probably about 30, 40 seconds. And then the fourth foul was a reach in where, I think, from my seat 2,000 miles away, it certainly looked like it could have been called a jump ball. Do you think the foul trouble at all affected him toward the end?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's just kind of natural when you're playing in a high level game like that. You're not gonna. I don't want to say you're not gonna take risks. I think everybody's gonna take risks in the Sweet 16, but you're not gonna be. It's gonna affect your play, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Obviously, especially on the defensive end when you don't want to pick up that fifth. There were some times where he got beat off the dribble. And kind of in some baseline out of bounds plays. I think there was a play that Texas Tech had drawn up for Christian Anderson or Elijah Hawkins, one of the two, I can't remember which, but somebody or one of them beat him to the 3-point line. There was a really good screen set and he couldn't recover. And there was some times like that. So maybe there's some stuff like that on the defensive end. I'm not sure that I would say it kind of affected his offense because, again, I think Texas Tech just really had phenomenal defensive adjustments to kind of limit him and limit his looks to tough opportunities. But I do think that some of the foul trouble definitely on the defensive end kind of affected things. I think we saw that just sitting there in the arena. And then, I think that is something that definitely affects the game.
Texas Tech saw so many threes at the end that it's hard to keep which one was which. But there was also one where they got one in transition late in the game, and Davis basically looked like miscommunication between him and another guard, and it left a Texas Tech shooter wide open for a three. That was another big part in that game. How about Carter Knox in the game that he had? 20 points last night. He went 4 for 4 from three, 6 for 8 overall. 4 or 5 at the line, should have gotten another free throw, a play that I thought should have been a 3-point play. It was called a foul on the floor. Whether or not that changed things in regulation, we'll never know. 6 rebounds last night for Carter Knox. I think you got to feel really good about Carter Knox moving forward, and we're going to talk more about the Razorbacks moving forward here in a couple of minutes. DJ Wagner, 13 points. Trevin Brazil with 11 points last night. Didn't get a whole lot from Jonas Adu offensively. 6 points. He gave him 9 rebounds. I thought he played really well defensively on JT Toppin for a good portion of that game. Missed a critical free throw, though. I mean, a 1-1, and it was a smart – I thought it was a very smart – I don't know if they were coached to do this. I don't know if this is just luck. But very smart for Texas Tech to foul Adu on that on that rebound because – if he gets it off to Nellie Davis or DJ Wagner, the end of that game may go totally different.
Yeah, no, for sure. And going back to Carter Knox, I thought he was phenomenal. I think he's really grown quite a bit throughout the whole season, and it'll be interesting to see whether or not he wants to test those NBA draft waters. I know we're gonna get more into big picture stuff later on, but he was really good. I mean, he had, like you said, 4 for 4 for 3. One of those was in the first half. He had hit his first two, and one was a super deep heat check, and I was like, oh man, what's he doing here? And then he hits it, and I was like, oh, he's on it. But no, he was really good, and I I commend, him and the coaching staff for the growth he's made throughout the season, especially later on. I think it was like midway through SEC play, when he kind of was inserted into the starting lineup. He just kind of took off from there and was really good. You mentioned Jonas Adu's defense. I thought he did do a good job on JT Toppin. The front end of the one-on-one is obviously tough because then Texas Tech goes down on the other end and ties the game. So that is that. But I mean, if you're Texas Tech, that's who you want taking those shots, those free throws, because Jonas Adu is he's not the greatest free throw shooter in the world, which I think teams have obviously picked up on. I mean, it's not the most difficult thing to see on the stat sheet. So when you're looking to put somebody at the line, that's probably who you want it to be, which I think Texas did that, or somebody did that. I don't remember exactly
Yeah,
who
it
it
was
was.
Texas.
Yeah. And obviously he made them pay in that regard. But yeah, it was just an entertaining basketball game, right? Like, watching as a neutral was it was a great basketball game to watch. It was just a lot of fun. That's what the NCAA tournament is. But yeah, I mean, there were certainly some good individual moments for sure. And if Arkansas can keep some of those guys, which I know we're going to get back to in a later segment, I think that would be certainly something to build on.
Arkansas missed out on an all-SEC final. It was a good night for the SEC, other than what happened to the Razorbacks. Alabama, what a performance last night against BYU, hitting 25 threes and winning that game. They'll play Duke in the Elite Eight.
Excuse me, I have to interject here. Alabama could have made 0 2-pointers and still won that game.
That's amazing.
It's incredible.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like that. Alabama's going to play Duke in the Elite Eight tomorrow. Florida is going to play Texas Tech in the Elite Eight tomorrow. We get four SEC teams in action tonight. You've got an all-SEC Sweet 16 game between Tennessee and Kentucky. Kind of interesting, Tennessee the higher seed, but Kentucky beat Tennessee twice during the regular season. So, they say it's hard to beat a team three times in a season. We'll see if Tennessee can end Kentucky's season tonight. And then on the other side, you get an Auburn-Michigan game tonight, and you've got an Ole Miss-Michigan State game tonight. Still the potential for an all-SEC Elite Eight in that region in Atlanta, and there's still the potential. The SEC is going to have teams in at least three of the Elite Eight games. The potential exists that the SEC could still have all Final Four teams, all four Final Four teams could come from the conference. We got a lot more to come with Anthony from San Francisco, but first, a word from our sponsors.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design, with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are Design.
Hey, welcome back. I want to tell you about our friends at Bentonville Glass. They have been serving their community since 1971. Committed, professional, versatile. If you're looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas or looking for skilled craftsmanship, look no further than Bentonville Glass for all your glass market needs with the highest quality products. Come by and see them now at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at bentonvilleglass.com. John Calipari lost for just the fourth time in the Sweet 16 last night. Kind of interesting, his four losses have come one time with all four of the teams that he coached. Happened once at UMass, once at Memphis, once at Kentucky, last time in 2018 at Kentucky, before it happened last night with his first Razorback team. Here's what he had to say about the Razorbacks' loss to Texas Tech in San Francisco.
Hard game. Two teams went at it, slugfest, and we're all disappointed here, but I told them there's nothing them individually or my team could do to disappoint me because of what they've done this year. So proud of them and proud of these two, but I'm proud of all the guys. Adu tried to play today. Boogie was still not there, but they all wanted to play to try to help their team. But give Texas Tech credit. They made plays down the stretch that gave them a chance, and they won the game.
No season. It's never hard to end a season, and you could really hear it in Calipari's voice last night. Anthony, just in this was a hard one for him. I think that, and he mentioned this a number of times. He said he really loved coaching this team. Said it was one of the favorite teams that he's ever coached. And I think when you've got that kind of, and I'd say there was an emotional investment in all of them, but when you've got maybe a little bit increased emotional investment in a team like this, it can really affect you. And I thought you could hear that in his voice last night. And then you couple that with the way the game ended. Just a really hard loss, I think, for John Calipari.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he said throughout the season, this is among the most rewarding teams he's coached just because of how much they've improved and how much, you know, that team has enjoyed being together, I guess, is kind of what he's kind of put it, how good the guys are and whatever. But yeah, you could definitely tell that, he didn't want the season to end, which, I mean, every coach is going to say they don't want the season to end. But yeah, you could tell that, it sucked for him, right? Like, I mean, they had one foot in the Elite Eight and watched it slip away, and that was that. But, I do think, he is correct to kind of point to the progress the team made throughout the season and kind of the things they overcame, just because, I mean, you remember their 0-5 start to SEC play. I think it ended up being a 1-6 start to SEC play, and yeah, 1-6 start to SEC play, if I'm not mistaken. But overcoming those injuries to Boogie Flan, to Due Thiro, other guys missed some time throughout, but yeah, you could tell that it definitely hurt him to lose that game. It hurt him to lose to Ole Miss in the SEC tournament as well. So you can definitely see how much I guess he cared about the team and how much he had just enjoyed coaching that team. Yeah,
an incredible turnaround for Arkansas. I mean, you think about the kind of the dialogue that we were having leading into the Kentucky game, the 1st of February, and none of us thought they were going to go into Kentucky and win that game. And nobody saw the type of turnaround that was coming, where they win at Kentucky and they win at Texas back to back, and it was just a wonderful, last 7 weeks or so, 8 weeks to this season. A lot of fun to watch. Team's going to be, I don't know how this team's going to be remembered, to be honest with you. Maybe it depends on how Calipari's tenure here at Arkansas goes. Did it lay the groundwork for something more special? Or was this the best it's going to get? I think that those are fair questions, at least in terms of NCAA tournament success, because we all know you can have great teams. It doesn't mean they're going to have success in the NCAA tournament. It's all about how you're playing right there at the end of the year. You look forward to next season, kind of turning the page. Arkansas, they're going to be without Nellie Davis. He's out of eligibility. They're going to be without Jonas Adu. He's without eligibility. Calipari said last night, Anthony, that he expects at least a couple of guys probably to enter the NBA draft. I think we all expect that Boogie Fland is going to be one of those. I don't think any of us are going to be surprised if Due Thiro is one of those that enters the NBA draft. And then you look at the other five and you wonder about, okay, are they going to be back? And let's run through them. Trevin Brazil, believe it or not, he's still got a year of eligibility remaining. We'll see if he's back in Arkansas next year. I guess I could probably see that going either way. Carter Knox was a freshman. Billy Richmond was a freshman. With a lot of these guys, DJ Wagner is another who's not a freshman, but he's got eligibility remaining. He was a sophomore. These are all players who, it's been well documented that their fathers or their brothers played for John Calipari. And so there's a little bit deeper investment, I feel like, in them with him maybe than other players. And so I can't pretend that I ever know what's going to happen in terms of players and the portal and NIL and everything else that goes into these decisions. But those three, I think I would be a little bit surprised if any of those three were not back next year. And then the other one is Zvonimir Visic, who's a sophomore who I think that they would love to have back for another year. But, again, you just never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, no, it's like you said, can't even try to predict anything with regard to the transfer portal or NIL or anything like that, just because it is such a just an unpredictable thing, right? You don't expect one person to enter their name into the portal and then they do, and that's that. Sometimes they go back to the team they were just at. Sometimes they don't. You know, sometimes they go to a rival, and they, you know, it's. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen by any means, but it's an interesting thing to look at. You know, you don't really know who is going to be back. Like he said last night, you know, he expects to have some guys enter the draft, which I think, you know, he's always going to expect that just because of his track record of getting guys into the NBA. And you would expect to certainly lose some guys to the portal. Every team basically loses guys to the portal. I think last season there's only, I think, four teams that didn't lose anybody to the portal, which is, you know, just kind of puts into perspective just how wild the portal gets. But it'll be interesting to see where they go. Do they want to go for more depth this year than they had? Or do they stick with this get nine guys for a rotation and see where it goes kind of method? Or, you know, where does that all go? How do they build the roster? How do they build the staff? Does another staff member go and get another job? Because John Calipari's talked about how his guys are capable of going and getting head coaching jobs. Is that something that's going to happen? Just because it is kind of getting late in the cycle. There's a lot of interesting things to monitor for sure. And just thinking about what the roster would look like for next season, when you think about, you know, the freshmen they've got coming in, Malik Thomas and Darius Acuff and Isaiah Seely, all high level guys. So, and then they've got the Kareem Ritel also, who is reportedly committed as well. So there's those guys coming in. How do they build around the guys they want to bring back and those guys? And it'll be fascinating to watch.
They've also got, they still got a high school senior kind of on the line, right?
Yeah. So, you know, do they bring him in? Does he go elsewhere? That's another thing on the line, is, or not on the line, like it's like this pressing issue, or maybe it is, but that'll be another thing to watch. You know, it is Nate Ament's recruitment, and just to see where he ends up. I think his final schools are Arkansas, Kentucky, Louisville, and I can't remember. I think there's another one in there as well. I can't remember off the top of my head which it is, but that'll be another one to watch, just because, you know, how many freshmen do you want to bring in is another question. So, and he's kind of said throughout, like, you can't bring in 7-8 freshmen. You can bring in 3 or 4. He's got 3 right now. So it'll be interesting to monitor that one as well.
Nate Ament's final 5, Arkansas, Duke, Louisville, Kentucky, and Tennessee. Those are the teams that he's supposed to choose from, I think, here very, very soon, because the late signing period begins here within, I think, about a week or so, certainly sometime in April. I think what we probably know about next year is that they're going to have more than 9 rotation players. I think that was something that even here at the end of the year, even though they had Thero available, they had Fland available, it still kind of bit them a little bit. I mean, you heard Calipari say after the game last night that Boogie, he played, but he wasn't, you know, he wasn't 100% back to the Boogie that they had, say, in like December. Thero, we all saw it last night. I mean, it was a ton of rust. Give him credit for going out there and trying to do something. But, you know, you could tell pretty quickly whenever he was on the floor that, you know, he just wasn't ready for that level of basketball yet. I think that, you know, when you look at the entire Calipari first year, you know, we're almost at the 1-year anniversary of him being hired. And so now the season's over, you go back and you look at everything that went into this season. I think, you know, the one glaring mistake I think that they made was that they just did not have enough rotation players. And I don't know if they would have gone any further in the tournament had they had, say, 10 or 11 players. But I certainly think that, you know, they would have had a lot more options than they had over the last couple of it would have made the last 2 to 3 months a lot easier, I suspect, had they been able to or made the decision to go out and get the, you know, the normal number of players that most basketball teams have.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I would be pretty surprised if they decided to run it back and try to do it with 8-9 guys again. Just because I don't think that's something that in the modern landscape of college basketball is going to lead to a lot of success, which obviously they ended up making the tournament and all of that. But like you said, it you know, could have been easier if they had, did have, you know, 10, 11 guys on their bench instead of 8 or 9.
Well, and you know, Anthony, it's not just about what happened on the floor at the end of the season. It's about, you know, they had some injuries in their, you know, so-called scholarship walk-ons, whatever they called these guys who never saw the floor this year. They had some injuries there too, and that's why they were never able to scrimmage 5-on-5 for a lot of the season. And so it just adds bodies, and I feel like that helps you whether they're playing in the game or not. It just helps you get ready for the games, if nothing else.
Yeah, for sure. I think there were different periods of time where Melo Sanchez was out. I think Kazmir Chavis was out for a period of time as well. So
Blake had an Achilles. I mean, it was a number of those players.
Yeah, so there is that, and that obviously is difficult. So do you want, you know, to get those extra bodies? I'm sure that'll be a big conversation point, and I'd be pretty surprised if they didn't try to get those guys in. So that's going to be something to watch, definitely.
Next year, what we know about the schedule next season, I should say, we know they're going to play Baylor in Chicago on Thanksgiving Day. I'm sorry, Duke in Chicago on Thanksgiving Day. Baylor's coming to Fayetteville at some point next season, and we know that Arkansas is going to get a home game as part of the SEC-ACC challenge. I would suspect there's another, you know, high-profile game or two in there, too, for John Calipari and this group. Now we have to kind of sit and wait. There's disappointment for the team, for the fans, that the season has ended. But I also think that this period now that's coming up of April and May, there's a feeling of great anticipation in terms of, okay, now you get to see how this roster is going to get built and how things are going to play out a little bit leading up to next year.
Yeah, for sure. And it's an exciting period for sure because you don't know who you're going to bring in through the portal. I think remembering last season, just kind of the excitement people felt when John L. Davis committed or Jonas Adu committed. You know, so that makes for some fun times, makes for some off-season content, things for me to do. You know, so that's always a good time. But it's going to be interesting to see how everything kind of comes together. Like you said, I'm sure they're going to have probably at least one more high-profile non-conference game, probably at a neutral site. That'll be interesting and fun to monitor, and you know, the portal and, you know, Nate Ament's recruitment, stuff like that will be interesting to see where they go. You know, what kind of roster do they want to build? What kind of style of play do they want to run? Obviously, I know John Calipari is kind of, you know, he runs his style of play, and that's kind of what he recruits to, which, you know, he's obviously had a ton of success with that. So there's that. It'll be interesting to see who he brings in to kind of, I guess, mold to a roster that plays in that way. So there's going to be a lot of news. I mean, basketball season never ends nowadays. So it's fun to follow, and I'm looking forward to covering it. That's for sure.
And one more note on scheduling. Remember, Calipari also said earlier this year, he said, you know, I think I'd kind of like to play a game in New York at Madison Square Garden every year. And I think he said that he'd like to play a game in Dallas every year at American Airlines Center. So the schedule should be kind of interesting to see how that falls into place next year as well. Anthony, appreciate your time. Have a safe trip home from San Francisco. When we come back, Christina Long's going to join me here in studio. We'll talk Razorback baseball. But first, a word from our sponsors.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over 4 decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
Hey, welcome back. Arkansas baseball in action tonight. 7 o'clock first pitch against Vanderbilt over at Hawkins Field in Nashville. This game's going to be televised by SEC Network with Tom Hart and Chris Burke on the call. Razorbacks obviously looking to bounce back after that tough midweek loss against Missouri State. 14-13, Vanderbilt comes into this game on a 5-game winning streak. The Commodores swept Texas A&M last week in SEC play. Of course, Arkansas swept South Carolina last week, too. Really, you know, with this matchup, I think, comes down to is you've got the unstoppable force, the Razorback lineup, and the immovable object, the Vanderbilt pitching staff. I mean, you look at the offensive and pitching categories, Arkansas is all over the top 10 offensive, Vanderbilt's all over the top 10 pitching. This is a really intriguing matchup to me to see how, you know, okay, Arkansas, they've played a couple of teams that I don't know that they got great pitching. Now they're going to play a team that's got the pitching on the road in their ballpark, a place that teams really have a lot of trouble winning. How are they going to be able to perform against this Vanderbilt pitching staff? I feel like over the next 3 days, we're going to learn a lot about this Razorback baseball team that we probably don't know yet because this is the best team they've seen.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think with the way that they started their SEC schedule, it kind of made it to where they could get started kind of on the right foot. That was something we talked about before those series, and they did that. They took care of that business. But I think you're right that this is, you know, such an interesting matchup and will teach us so much about this lineup. And I think, you know, if it doesn't go the way that it's gone in the last few weeks with so much offense, then I do think there's going to be a lot of anxiety about that. But I mm-hmm. also think that the thing to remember will be that this is one of the better pitching staffs they're going to face. And one thing I noticed just looking at, you know, your kind of rundown of the game was how similar some of the pitching stats have been so far between yes. Arkansas and Vanderbilt stats or starters. Their mm-hmm. numbers are almost identical.
Well, and it's that way, especially tonight. And, you right. know, even to the point that it's a couple of junior left-handers in this game tonight. Of course, Zach Root's going to start for Arkansas. Vanderbilt's going to start a left-hander, J.D. Thompson. And, you know, to Christina's point about the stats, Root, a 4.02 ERA, Thompson, a 4.06, Root, a 1.18 whip, Thompson, a 1.03 whip, even down to Root's thrown 31 and a third innings, Thompson's thrown 31 innings.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting.
Almost identical. So, yeah, I think the pitching matchup tonight will be really interesting to watch. But, yeah, I mean, I think as far as the offense goes, there's been so much excitement about this offense. And, you know, I was talking on the radio the other day about how, and we've talked on the podcast before about how, the offense after last season, the offense was kind of the biggest question coming into this season because it was how much better is it going to be? What is it going to be like? And it's been so much better, I think, than a lot of people thought. I mean, I didn't think it was going to be bad. I thought they would maybe get some improvement after they really kind of went into this season. They attacked the offseason and went out to get kind of the pieces that they felt like they were missing in the lineup. And I think they've done that. But I think you're right that in terms of the talent they're going to face, this is going to be the first real test.
Hawkins Field in Nashville, it's an interesting place to play. If you've never been there, I'll try to explain it to you a little bit. Number one, it's an all-turf field. I believe it's one of only two, well, actually three now, because Georgia just went to a turf field.
But oh,
I think,
did they?
I think it's only there's only three all-turf fields, at least out of the 14 teams that were in the conference last year.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what Texas and OU have. Yeah. I should have looked that up a little bit. But the point being, there's not a lot of
Texas.
I think, well, I know Texas at one point they were all turf, and that was, you know, something they were quite proud of. But the point being, there's not a lot of all turf fields in the SEC, and Vanderbilt's got one of them. You play on turf, it's different than playing on dirt. There's no doubt about that. Other things that make Vanderbilt Stadium unique: you've got the Green Monster in left field. It's a 35-foot wall in left. That's, you know, I mean, it's supposed to be, I guess, a replica of the Fenway Monster in Boston. That's something you see that at Vanderbilt, you see that at Auburn. And then really the thing that makes it real unique, maybe outside of the Whistlers, is the fact that it's built into the side of their football stadium.
Which is crazy.
It's really strange. It's so down the right field, first baseline, there are no concourses. You walk in, you walk to your seat, and that's that. There's a little, you know, just a little walkway that gets you up to your seats. You go down the left field third baseline, and it shares a concourse with the football stadium. So, I mean, you can literally take a right and go out to the baseball field, or you can take a left and go out and look at the football stadium.
Do they, like, rope it off at all, or can you just kind of wander the football stadium if you get into the
baseball
game?
You probably can. I would
Although right now, I'm sure they have some stuff with the construction that they've had going on. I'm sure there's safety precautions.
Yeah, when I was there 2 years ago, it was and they've totally changed that area, too. There was a little street that used to run back behind the football and the baseball stadium that they've totally – like, it's not a street anymore because they're building onto that mm-hmm. street. I think they're building some sort of football – operations complex or something right there. And so that's changed. But yeah, it's very weird because they share a concourse. And so when you go to the restroom, you're going to a restroom in the football stadium.
That's so funny.
When you get concessions, you are getting concessions from a football concession stand. It's unlike any place that I know of that exists in college baseball. But you know what? Vanderbilt's really good there. They're 16-0 at home. They've got a 17-game home win streak going back to last season. And it's been 15 years since Arkansas won there. Only three ballparks in the SEC where Arkansas has not won in the last 15. The other two are Texas and Oklahoma, where they haven't played an SEC game in the last 15 years. Dave Van Horn, I asked him earlier this week about what makes Vanderbilt's baseball stadium just such a tough place for opponents to play, and this is what the Razorbacks coach had to say.
There's no foul territory. The benches are not too far from the fair foul lines, and you know, different background, but it's still baseball field. Just got to get used to it a little bit. But the surface is quick. It's all turf, and you know, they play their style of ball, and they really do it well at home.
Arkansas went to Nashville yesterday, went through a workout last night on their field. And you know, a coach that's as detail-oriented as Van Horn is, I mean, they're out there, they're hitting balls off that monster. Hey, here's how you read a ball off the left field wall. You know, they're hitting them high hoppers in the infield. Hey, here's how the ball bounces on this turf. It's so important to get in there the day before. But even at that, there's such a advantage to a team that has that plays all their games there, that they practice there. That's where they're practicing. That's where they play fall ball. And, you know, it's just, I think you see that in how good Vanderbilt's been at home. They know all the quirkiness of that ballpark.
Yeah, I think especially when you're talking about an all-turf field that's so different than what Arkansas is used to playing on. It reminds me of the conversation I had with the track coaches about their first road meet being at the SEC Championships. And, you know, track is different because the surfaces can all vary so much. And so, you know, track is a sport where it matters a lot, the facility. And so if you're not, you know, Texas A&M has a brand new facility, so they were in a brand new building and they didn't know anything about it, and it was hard to kind of adjust. So it reminds me a little bit of that, where, you know, anytime you go on the road, it's hard. You know, there's always home field advantage. But I think when you're dealing with something like that, where the facility is different and the surfaces are different, it can change so much for you.
I've talked to coaches too, who said, and you actually heard Dave say that a little bit in his soundbite, but that they recruit a type of athlete that the field, it's weird. It's like they recruit a type of athlete that is made for that type of surface. Mm. Like an Enrique Bradfield is one that I think of. I mean, think about how many infield hits that guy had because of his speed and the way, you know, that he hit, you know, those little hoppers. And obviously he has the stolen base record at Vanderbilt, maybe for the SEC too. I can't remember for sure, but, you know, obviously it was just an elite player there for them. They just, you know, and Corbin's done a great job there. There's a reason he's won two national championships and lost in the title game two other times. I mean, he really knows what he's doing. And this is a tough, tough place to play. And I think we're talking with Andrew Harris about this yesterday a little bit. I think it sneaks up on people how tough Vanderbilt is to play, because you get in there, it's like, well, there's only 3,700 seats. This isn't Duty Noble. This isn't Alex Box. This isn't Baum. But it's not about all the people in the seats sometimes.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember you telling me about kind of this stadium setup last year. I didn't really know anything about it. I'd never been out there. I've never actually really been to Nashville besides driving through. Hmm. And I remember you telling me about it, and I was so surprised about the concourse aspect. And, you know, so I would love to see a game there, just A, because of how strange the stadium is, and B, because I do think it is a cool environment despite the, you know, smaller capacity. And so I'd be interested, you know, what it's like to go to a game there.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Do you like whistling?
Not particularly.
Well, I don't know if you'd like it too
yeah,
much.
Yeah, my dad is going to a Vanderbilt game at some point this year, and he was like, he's going to Nashville for, you know, an event, and what part of it is to go to a Vanderbilt game. And he's like, I don't even know if I can go, because I don't know if I can sit through the whistling. He's like, I don't know if I can.
And there's two of them.
Oh, are there two?
There's two.
Oh, I just know about like the Whistler. I didn't know.
No, there's two Vandy Whistlers.
Oh, okay. I thought it was just the one.
No, there's
two. Has there always been two?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah. It's like they play off of each other there at their stadium. And then I think only one of them really travels a whole lot.
Interesting.
And he's got kind of a creeper van, to be honest with you. It's black. And it says the Whistler on the side, and it's got all this Vanderbilt, you know, regalia, I guess, on the side. I know this because it was at the same hotel I was at one time.
That's so funny.
When Arkansas was playing in Arlington the same weekend that Vanderbilt was there. So they take some pride in the fact that they are, you know, the Whistlers.
I wonder, like, if players and coaches, I wonder if it just kind of becomes background noise to them, or if they like it, or if it bothers them.
Like, when I was there, I didn't notice it.
I guess it reminds me of, like, the Mississippi State cowbells. Like, for us, it is horrible and painful and makes the game experience terrible because we're not used to it.
How about the woos at Baum?
I know. Well, I was thinking about that too. You know, Ric people Flair talk woo. About how they don't like. Oh, I was talking about just like the hog call. Like a lot of people talk about how they don't like.
I'm talking about the Ric Flair. You know.
Yeah. I don't find that my voice annoying, but maybe I'm used to it.
My voice still can't get real high after that sickness that
you'll
I went
never
through.
Recover. The
I don't know that
do
I ever
that.
Will. It's but you know it's like people. It's like this bothers me on TV. It's like I don't even notice it. I hear really? It so much. I don't even it doesn't. Doesn't faze
yeah,
me.
I feel like, and I think that's kind of what I was talking about is like, I do wonder if they get used to it because that I don't even notice because I'm so used to it. And so, yeah, it doesn't bother me at all or like take me out of the game.
So the Whistlers, there's another interesting
a quirk
part
of Vanderbilt baseball.
That's right. So pitching matchups this weekend, we mentioned J.D. Thompson, Zach Root tonight. Gabe Gackel is going to stay in starting rotation for Arkansas. I think he's got to have some length in the start this week, or they might make a move there. He's going to pitch against Cody Bowker, a junior right-hander in Game 2 for Vanderbilt. Bowker, a 2-1 record, 2.64 ERA. And then Game 3, kind of an interesting matchup. You've got Landon Meidelshees for Arkansas, no surprise there. Vanderbilt's turning to this sophomore right-hander, Connor Fennell, who is a transfer from Dayton, who had not started a game for them until last Thursday. And in order to keep their Friday and Saturday starters on normal rest, they started this kid against Texas A&M, and all he did was have 8 strikeouts in 3 2/3 innings. And they're like, whoa, this is a revelation. I was listening to Tim Corbin this week on a podcast that's school run. It's called the Commodore Hour. And he mentioned about Fennell. He said that Jace LaViolette took him deep last week in the A&M series. And he said, I guess it's maybe just the New Hampshire in him, you know, live free or die. And he said, you know, it's like, okay, I'm going to throw a fastball right down the middle to the next batter. And it was like that mentality and the way that he challenged the next hitter after, you know, things could have gone a little bit awry for him that really stood out to them. Vanderbilt, from what I've heard, whether it be from Andrew yesterday, we heard him talk about this, or obviously listening to Tim Corbin, Mark Etheridge from D1 Baseball was talking to me about this kid a few days ago. This is like a big revelation for them in the last week and a half or so.
That's so interesting. I'll be curious how he does, you know, because that was his first start. And, you know, you talked off the top about the unstoppable force and the immovable object. Mm-hmm. Arkansas's lineup is the best Vanderbilt's going to have faced this year, too. I mean, they had Auburn, which, you know, good team, they're ranked, whatever. And then Texas A&M.
Struggling. Not the lineup we thought they were
going to. Yeah, so... You know, this is also going to be the biggest test Vanderbilt's pitching has faced. And I think, you know, a guy like this that's still new at it and had a good performance, you know, is it going to be – can he continue it, or will there be a wake-up call, or will it kind of meet in the middle, will be something to watch on Sunday?
The SEC availability report came out last night. Gage Woods still out for Arkansas. Not going to pitch in this series. We'll see about next weekend against Missouri. Missouri would be 6 weeks post-injury against Michigan. And remember, the initial timeline for his recovery from the shoulder injury said 3 to 6 weeks. Dave Van Horn talked about him earlier this week, said he's getting better. And so we'll see if we see him next week. Logan Maxwell's listed on here as probable. Of course, he's been dealing with that hamstring injury. And Parker Coyle on here again. Listed as probable. Again, they don't give reasons why the players are on here. And when I asked Dave Van Horn last week, he didn't want to say what was going on with Parker Coyle, but he's listed as probable. Remember, he was probable last week, and then he ended up pitching well, I thought, against South Carolina. The availability reports, they've added a new wrinkle to how we have to cover. It's a new wrinkle for both sides. I mean, it's now we have to say, okay, this exists. And I think for the coaches, it's a wrinkle for them too. Like, hey, you know, you don't have to put what the injury is, but you want to be, you know, based on the way the rules are written, you have to be pretty forthcoming about this. It's a weird dynamic. I really wish if they were going to have an availability report, let's just make it a true injury report and say shoulder, back, knee, whatever, yeah. Wrist. But, you know, baby steps, I guess, to get to that point. I'm sure that's coming. It's just there's probably going to have to be a lot of, you know, give and pull until you get to that point.
Yeah, and I think different coaches have different approaches to how they talk about it when they're asked. Because, you know, we get the availability report, and I think in some of their minds, including Dave Van Horn, the idea is, okay, now that we have – these injury reports, or sorry, availability reports, now I don't have to answer questions about injuries. And it's like, actually, no, it makes it almost even more for us to, because we know there's some kind of issue and we want to know what it is. They do not have to tell us. It is their decision whether or not they want to share it. But I do feel like whenever you say, I'm not going to tell you, it kind of creates the idea that maybe it's more severe and they don't want to reveal how severe it is. And then you get worried, and then Parker Coyle ends up pitching anyway, and it's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a kind of an odd dynamic, and every coach handles it differently.
I don't want to say what's going on with Parker Coyle because I was told it in confidence to where, you know, I don't want you to report this. And so I'm going to not burn the people who have told me about this. But I do think that I'm comfortable saying that this is something he has been dealing with for a good bit of the season. So this isn't a new injury. It's just that the availability reports are now recent, because they were not required before SEC play began.
So you have to name it even if it's not something that would actually necessarily hold them out. That's what probably
I guess.
Is.
And again, I think there's a level of ambiguity there, you know, in terms of like, you know, does every coach approach it the same way?
Right, because I think in football we kind of see some discrepancy in how who gets listed across different teams. I think that was something we started to see come up. And because, you know, they have the final one before the game. Does baseball do the final one day of the game, too?
Yes.
The same way?
Although, against South Carolina last week, the SEC forgot to update it.
Oh, that's
right. And
really
I think
funny.
I don't know this for sure, but I was talking to someone at Arkansas. I'm like, you know, they haven't updated this. And I have a suspicion that the SEC got a message like, hey, you need to.
That's really funny.
You need to get on top of
this.
So my expectation is whenever this is, it's supposed to be updated 2 hours before first pitch, which would be somewhere around 5 o'clock this afternoon. My expectation is that Gage Wood's going to be the only player that's listed on this. I would be very surprised if Maxwell or Coyle do not play because they're listed as probable and it's the same
and they were
as
last
week.
Yeah. And Maxwell, we've known about the hamstring thing and he's played through it and it seems like he's getting better over the course of the season.
And Rocco Pepi not on this one this week. He was on the availability report last week, but never played.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
So we'll see how Arkansas can do, trying to win their first series at Vanderbilt in 15 years. I want to mention this too. Ole Miss, they haven't lost since Arkansas beat them. Now, I don't know that they played great competition. They played Missouri, no offense, last week.
It's factual.
And they swept Missouri. And then last night they beat Florida. Florida 0-7 now in the SEC. The two SEC teams, I think this is correct. I think Missouri's got a win. I think the two SEC teams right now without a conference win are Texas A&M and Florida, a couple of preseason top five teams.
Wow. Shout out to Missouri. not being in that group. Against all odds.
Sometimes I forget that Missouri's an SEC baseball team. I really do.
Like, they do too.
Well, yesterday, I was going through last week or a couple of weeks ago. I was looking something up, and it was like Arkansas's all-time, you know, win records against SEC programs. I totally
didn't even look at Missouri.
I just totally forgot Missouri.
That's so
and,
funny.
And then yesterday I was looking at all these ballparks where Arkansas is, you know, like what was the last time that they won at each SEC ballpark? Because I thought Vanderbilt was the longest streak that they had. And again, initially I forgot to look up Missouri.
Yeah, that's funny. I've maybe told this story on the podcast before, but like about how when I, you know, I grew up like Arkansas baseball and going to Arkansas baseball games and taking photos at them was like part of why I got into the business that I'm in. And like part of why I chose Missouri for college because I wanted to do journalism. And then I like get to Missouri and I go to a Missouri baseball game and I was like, oh, not everyone does college baseball the same, you know? But you know, I'll be the first to admit when Missouri is bad at things because I think if you can't make fun of your own family, then, you know, you gotta.
Missouri's here next week. If Arkansas can, if they can get a series win over Vanderbilt, they got a chance to get a really nice head start on the SEC standings. Don't want to get too far ahead of yourself.
Sure.
But
this weekend is a big challenge.
If they can win this weekend, it seems like it can really create some good momentum for the Razorbacks based a little bit on what the schedule looks like the next week or so. All right, we appreciate you being here. Hope everybody has a great weekend. We're going to have a lot of coverage at our website, wholehogsports.com. Ethan and Anthony will have some follow-up coverage from last night's NCAA tournament before they head out of San Francisco. Of course, we'll be covering Razorback baseball, Razorback softball in action this week against Kentucky. And I'm sure there's going to be plenty more going on in Razorback world. Hope we see you at our website, wholehogsports.com. And we hope we see you on our podcast on Monday.